From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Political scientist Daniel McCool says when it comes to America's rivers, there's been a disconnect between our actions and our desires. Quote, nearly all of our rivers are developed, dammed, diverted, dried up, or dirtied. But increasingly, Americans want rivers that are clean, free-flowing, teeming with fish and wildlife, and inviting for sports and recreation, unquote. The good news, McCool says, is that we're moving toward healthier waterways. And he says this movement is being led by ordinary folk, concerned citizens who want to reclaim the American landscape. Today on the program, Dan McCool joins us to describe the brighter future for America's rivers. Plus, the latest rules governing the endangered Utah prairie dog and the view from the southern Utah town of Parowan. All that and your calls after the news. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Historically, America's rivers have been developed, polluted, and neglected, but political scientist Daniel McCool asserts that the nation's waterways are returning to a healthier, free-flowing condition thanks to concerned citizens and grassroots activism. Today on the program, Dan McCool joins us to talk about the good news and the brighter outlook for America's rivers. Daniel McCool is a professor of political science and the director of Environmental and Sustainability Studies program at the University of Utah. His research focuses on water resource development, public lands policy, voting rights, and Indian water rights, and he's the author and co-author of 9 books, including his latest, titled River Republic, The Fall and Rise of America's Rivers. And Dan McCool joins me in studio. Professor McCool, it's great to have you. Thanks so much for your time.
Hello. Good morning, Jennifer.
Later on in the program, dealing with the Utah prairie dog, but first, river restoration. Have you noticed that your favorite fishing holes or river runs are cleaner and more vibrant than, say, 30 years ago? What is motivating your neighbors and friends to push for river improvements? You can join our conversation. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We're going to walk through your thesis that you present in the book as we go, but I want to start with an incident that you write about, your first encounter or an early encounter with rivers, building a raft as a 10-year-old Boy Scout in Indiana. What did that experience teach you about rivers and what rivers should be?
Well, we weren't actually Boy Scouts. I suppose if we were, we might have built a raft a little better. But there were 3 of us, and this was a very makeshift raft. But for little kids growing up in central Indiana, there's not much open space. There's not many places you can explore. But the one thing you can do, you get on a river, who knows where that goes? That's a highway for adventure for young boys. So we just decided we'd build a raft and take off. And the problem with the raft is that it didn't quite have enough buoyancy, so it floated just a couple inches below the water surface. And we had poles for locomotion. And so we went cruising down the river. In this case, it's called Fall Creek. And there are all these fishermen on the side that suddenly they see these 3 kids coming along with nothing visibly supporting them. So we were quite the spectacle. But as we continued down the river, the raft sank lower and lower and lower. And finally, we had to abandon ship and crawl to shore and try to figure out where we were. And, of course, then we had to walk home. So it was a big adventure for little kids in Indiana. That river's the only possibility of adventure and excitement and the unknown downriver for us.
Is that what continues to draw all of us to the river? Is it adventure? It leads us to places we haven't experienced before. Or is it more than that?
Well, that's a big part of it. Rivers are an important part of our culture. If you go to some of these websites that have song lyrics on them, you'll find that there's something like 35 songs simply called The River. So rivers are symbolic. They're the ultimate metaphor for people. They stand for life. They stand for something unknown downstream, and they're always changing. You never get in the same river twice. It's always different. So rivers offer an awful lot to people, and that's why I think we're enchanted with them, have been historically, and are even more so today.
I mentioned in my introduction that your latest book traces the history of, you know, how we're thinking about rivers and recent efforts to reclaim rivers. What got you thinking about river restoration and sort of the big picture, the trend of how Americans look at caring for rivers?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's looking at river restoration is it's one of the few places where there's good news, where you can be a realist and an optimist, where environmental conditions are actually improving rather than deteriorating. So if you want to be upbeat and enjoy life and kind of look at the good things, rivers are a good place to look. The other thing I really like about studying rivers and restoration is that America is so polarized today. And the ideologues have taken over government, and it's ugly and nasty. But if you look at these restoration projects, ideology is largely irrelevant.
Did that surprise you?
Well, there might be a perception that it's only environmentalists or only the greenies who care about rivers, and that's simply not true. Everybody wants a nice river in their neighborhood. Nobody wants a stinking, polluted river going by. So the typical river restoration project has a very broad range of support, has nothing to do with liberals and conservatives, everything to do with your community. River restoration is economic development, and it's community restoration. So the coalitions that come together to restore rivers are often this very disparate group that might not agree on anything else, but they want fish in the river, they want clean water in the river, they want the river to be flowing, they don't want a dry riverbed, and they want the river to add to their quality of life. It makes their neighborhood nicer, it increases their property values. Real estate people like them because nobody wants to live next to a stinking, fetid river, but everybody loves to live next to a beautiful river.
The Babbling Brook.
Oh, yeah. Just think of, you want to increase property values? Well, just go to the waterfront in places where the waterfront is beautiful. If you look at a place like Pittsburgh, in the book I talk about how it used to be one of the stinkiest, foulest places on the place of the earth. And a couple years in a row, it's been rated the most livable city in the United States. And it's largely because they cleaned up their riverfront and they cleaned up the water. So it's a nice place, and the cool place to live in Pittsburgh is on the river today.
Speaking with Daniel McCool, he's a professor of political science and the director of the Environmental and Sustainability Studies Program at the University of Utah. His new book is titled River Republic, The Fall and Rise of America's Rivers. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. River Republic, this concept that it's a grassroots movement. It's kind of bubbling up from the ground up. And you highlight a local activist, Zach Frankel, at the mm-hmm. beginning of your book. I mean, what was it about Zach's experience and his activism that inspired you to look at broader trends throughout the nation?
Well, the story of how Zach Frankel started the Utah Rivers Council is an inspiring one. Zach came to my office. Oh, this was back in the 90s, and I had published a book actually with my students on Utah water politics. It's still the only book written on Utah water politics, which is surprising because Water is so important and so controversial. There's so much politics and law going into Utah water. But
the grad students out there, you've got your opening.
I know. Somebody else write a book here. But Zach came to my office, and he was kind of this naive young kid at the time, and said he wanted to save some of Utah's rivers, and he was going to lobby the legislature. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, this guy has no idea what he's getting himself into. But that's actually what was so good about it. He didn't realize that failure was on the agenda. So he just decided that success was on the agenda. And Zach looked at my files and did his homework and went from someone who really didn't understand politics to someone who developed a tremendous understanding of not only the politics of Utah water, but the economics of Utah water. And Zach started the Utah Rivers Council, and ultimately they helped stop a dam on the Diamond Fork River. And an absolutely impossible task. If you'd ask anybody, could this upstart little organization, working in conjunction with other environmental organizations and other interests, actually stop a dam that was part of this massive project called the Central Utah Project? Everyone would have said, no, that's impossible. And they did the impossible. And that's what led me to start looking at other possibilities like that. If Zach can pull that off, are there people like that saving other rivers in America? So I started doing some research, and I thought maybe I might find a few projects. And what I found were hundreds of projects all across America, that there are Zach Frankels all over the place who have this impossible notion that they're going to take that miserable, dried up, dirty, foul river out there and make something decent out of it and turn it into a community asset. And that's what inspired me to write the book.
Mm. You cite some statistics. There are 79,000 major dams in the U.S., an additional 2.5 million small dams. 85% of the inland water in America is artificially controlled. What is the state of America's rivers right now?
Well, they're not in very good shape, but they're getting better. We are making progress. This is really a problem of supply and demand. We have so few natural, living, healthy, flowing rivers. But that's what people want today. They want to recreate in them. They want to live next to them. They want the wildlife associated with that. But only a tiny portion of our rivers actually meet that criteria. So the river restoration movement is really an effort to increase the supply of beautiful rivers to meet the demand. And I think that's why they're successful and why there's such broad support for these restoration efforts, because there's so many people that want that, that want a river that works for them.
And they're considered assets now to a community. We did a show recently about a new vision for the Jordan River right here in Salt Lake Valley, and how trails and some limited commercial development will transform that waterway from this kind of negative ditch into a jewel in the valley.
Yes. 25 years ago, when I first moved to Salt Lake, the thought of going to the Jordan River for anything other than dumping tires or dead bodies, that's the image that we had of the Jordan River. And now it's becoming a great community asset. As we restore it, we clean it up, we take care of the riparian areas, we provide for public access. It's a great community asset.
And in your book, you trace that, you know, that's happening all over the country. Speaking with Daniel McCool, a professor of political science and the director of Environmental and Sustainability Studies Program at the University of Utah. His new book is titled River Republic, The Fall and Rise of America's Rivers. And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Rivers are on the rebound. That's the conclusion of 10 years of research by political scientist Daniel McCool. From Los Angeles to Boston to Cataract Canyon, McCool says America's rivers are being cleaned up and protected. Today on the program, McCool is with us to talk about the ways in which ordinary folk, you and I, are challenging and changing the status quo for America's rivers. Daniel McCool is a professor of political science and the director of environmental and sustainability studies at the University of Utah. His latest book, River Republic, The Fall and Rise of America's Rivers. And you can join us if you like. Have you noticed that your favorite fishing holes or river runs are cleaner and more vibrant than a couple of decades ago? What changes have you seen in the rivers that you love? 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Dan McCool, you write that the two major water agencies in the United States were created for missions that are completely irrelevant today. Talk about the problems that you see with the Army Corps of Engineers and the Bureau of Reclamation, and just why you think these agencies are outdated.
Mm-hmm. It's not so much that the agencies are outdated, it's their mission that is outdated. The Corps of Engineers was created to clear rivers so we can move troops up and down the rivers. Last time I looked, we're not moving a lot of troops up and down rivers in riverboats and such. So the Corps has evolved. The problem with the Corps is that they've expanded to include river restoration and environmental protection, but they still give priority to all their old missions. And some of their projects make sense, and some of them are just crazy, just economically irrational by any accounting. The Bureau of Reclamation was created to settle the West. We can look out the window right now and see that settling the West is not a major problem for us right now.
Mission accomplished.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. We're done. We don't need you giving away projects and water and subsidizing more people coming out West. We have plenty of people here. The West is on fire in part because we have so many people out here. So in the book, I propose that both of these agencies undergo a process similar to the BRAC Commission. The BRAC Commission was a congressionally created commission that closed unnecessary military bases. Congress realized it didn't have the courage, the spine, to actually close any bases, so they delegated that to a commission. I think they should do that for water projects. And the ones that make economic sense, that are actually viable, we should keep. And the ones that are just a big government waste, and there are water projects that are just the premier examples of wasteful government spending on a mega scale. We're $15 trillion in debt. We can't afford to support those projects anymore. That doesn't make sense in an age where we just don't have the money. So I would like to see just an assessment. Let's leave the good projects in place if they can actually meet some rational criteria. And then let's think about de-emphasizing and deauthorizing the projects that don't make economic and environmental sense.
So when you say projects, are you talking, you're talking about diverting waterways, pipelines, dams?
All kinds of projects, channelized rivers, locks and dams for the barging industry, some agricultural projects, a small number of dams. Most dams are good dams. I'm not anti-dam. I'm anti-dumb dam. That's the difference. Some dams, most dams, in fact, make a lot of sense.
So what makes a dam dumb?
Well, it's a calculus of cost and benefits on a large scale.
Give us an example. What's a dumb one?
Well, it's Condit Dam on the White Salmon River in the state of Washington. You can YouTube that, and you'll see cameras sitting on the dam, and all of a sudden there's this massive explosion, and the bottom of the dam seems to just come apart, and the entire reservoir drains out this hole they just blasted in it. The Condit Dam produced a small amount of hydropower, and it killed a large amount of salmon. The salmon run and the river as a viable recreation and fishing resource was far more valuable than the tiny amount of electricity generated by that dam. So it made economic sense and environmental sense and community sense to remove that dam. Mm-hmm. And in fact, last year, something like, I think 60 dams came out last year. Now, recall, we have almost 80,000 dams.
80,000.
So nobody's talking about removing America's dams. We're talking about removing a small portion of dams, channelized rivers. For example, the Corps of Engineers realized the Kissimmee River Project, where they killed an entire river system in Florida, was a really stupid idea. And to their credit,
they've tried to reverse that, as you document in the book.
They are reversing it. They're rebuilding. They're putting that river back. And it's beautiful. I've been down the restored section. It's stunning what they've accomplished there. It's also stunning how much money they've spent both tearing it up and putting it back. Mm. They would have saved the taxpayers a lot of money if they just hadn't done it in the first place. So there's some dumb projects out there, and we need to think about abandoning those, keeping the good ones.
There's, speaking of classifying a good dam from a dumb dam, what do you think about the Glen Canyon Dam and Lake Powell? You spent some time on it in the book, but explain
yes.
to our listeners, I mean, the virtues and the costs associated with that project.
Yes. Well, Glen Canyon Dam would not be built today. If that idea was proposed today, it would not be politically viable. On the other hand, politics is not going to remove Glen Canyon Dam. That is not going to happen. However, I think Lake Powell is history, and it's not history because of environmental opposition. It's history because of upstream diversions and climate change. All the models indicate that the Upper Colorado River Basin is going to become more arid, and there are multiple proposals to divert more water upriver of Lake Powell. So at some point, the question of whether we keep Glen Canyon Dam and Lake Powell simply becomes moot. What I think will happen is that there is some sense in placing that water in Lake Mead. Lake Mead's the primary water source for Las Vegas. Mm. Las Vegas is, whatever you think of Las Vegas, we're not going to allow it to dry up and blow away. That's not an option. So they're going to have to get some water somewhere. And I think the Colorado River is the sensible place to get it. So we're going to see a reworking of the politics and the allocation of water in the Colorado River Basin over the next 20 years. And that reworking probably will doom Lake Powell. Lake Powell offers enormous benefits. There are millions of people that absolutely love Lake Powell. It's probably the most beautiful reservoir in the world. There's also a beautiful canyon down there. So I can understand both sides of that argument, and it's going to change primarily because of upstream allocations and climate change.
Speaking with Daniel McCool, professor of political science and director of the Environmental and Sustainability Studies Program at the University of Utah. His new book is titled River Republic: The Fall and Rise of America's Rivers. And if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Let's go to the phones, and Phil is joining us from Salt Lake City. Phil, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Hey, I just wanted to ask, speaking of dams, I just got back from Redfish Lake in Idaho, and what is the status of removing all those dams that impede the return of the salmon up the Columbia and the Salmon River?
Dam McCool?
Good question. Redfish Lake, of course, used to be called that because the salmon runs were so dense in that lake, and they turn red when they spawn that it was just thick. There was a year not long ago where there was only one returning salmon to Redfish Lake. The controversy right now is over whether four dams on the Lower Snake River should be breached. That's at a standstill right now. The judge who has had a major impact on that just retired, so we'll see who the next judge is, and that could have a big impact on which way that's going. But right now, the dams are in place. We'll have to see who replaces Judge Redden.
Hmm. Phil, you said you just returned from that part of the country. Do you support removing the dams? I mean, what do you want to see done with the rivers in that area of Idaho?
Well, I think the salmon population up there, if we lose that species of salmon, they'll never be replaced. They're the only, the Chinook and the King salmon, the sockeye, they're the only salmon that run that many miles, and if they're lost, they will never be able to be restored. The thing that's interesting to me as I've looked at it is, you know, they try and put a couple million fish out a year, and those fish won't mate with fish that are naturally spawned. And so all their efforts seem to be continuing to fail. So they've got to do something.
Hmm. Phil, thanks very much for the call. Before I let you go, how do you classify yourself? Are you an environmentalist, or are you a recreationalist? I mean, what's your interest in river health?
Well, I don't know. I'd have to stop and think about that. I enjoy the rivers. But I think that we need to take care of our planet. I think that our chief purpose should be stewardship over this planet that we live on, because if we don't take care of it, who will?
Phil, thanks so much for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. Response to Phil's comments, Dr. McCool?
Well, one of the primary reasons why rivers are being restored all across America is to increase fish and wildlife, both in riparian areas and in the water itself. The anadromous fish runs, those are the fish that spawn in freshwater and mature in seawater and then return, like salmon and steelhead. They have enormous market value, and they're disappearing. I mean, the salmon in the Northwest are in crisis mode. We've made some progress because of all the efforts, so the counts are up. In fact, in some rivers, there were record numbers last year. But the record numbers are a tiny fraction of the historic runs. We're not even remotely close to restoring historic runs. So the effort in the Northwest, many of the dam removals and river restoration efforts there are directed towards restoring anadromous fish runs, which have great cultural importance to local people. They're important to the tribes in the area, and they have enormous economic value in that area.
Many of the dams that were built on the rivers in America were justified because they were creating electricity. But you say that there is some question as to whether this hydropower should be classified as a clean, an alternative power source. I mean, what are the questions surrounding the cost and benefits with hydropower?
people often call hydropower a renewable form of energy. I think that's a mistake. I don't consider it that. All dams are temporary. All dams will eventually fall down, and all reservoir sites will eventually silt in. And the impacts on fish and wildlife from dams is permanent. Extinction, you know, lasts a long time. So I don't consider that renewable. Hydropower will remain an important part of our energy portfolio, no doubt about it. It generates about 10% of our electricity in America. In the Northwest, it's much greater. However, there's plenty of room to consider removing small, inefficient hydropower dams that add very little power to the grid, but have tremendous economic and environmental liabilities. I think it's kind of ironic that if you add up the amount of electricity that would be saved by changing light bulbs and using more efficient appliances, it totals about 10%. In other words, the same amount that's produced by hydropower. So just by changing light bulbs and having more efficient refrigerators, we'd save the same amount of power that is produced by all the hydro dams in America. So when the proponents of hydropower say, well, do you want to sit around in the cold in the dark? That's not the alternative. The alternative is, why don't we use some common sense, increase the efficiency, and balance out all the different advantages and disadvantages to hydropower and make some informed decisions here. Mm.
The 7th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina is coming up this week. And you spend some time in the book talking about development in flood zones, mm-hmm. How rivers figure into all of this. The chapter is titled or subtitled The Myth of Flood Control. I mean, what can realistically be done to prevent major flooding near major rivers?
Well, there's no such thing as flood control. rivers vary in volume. And if you're foolish enough to put your house in the way, you're going to have trouble. And the government can mitigate that, usually at huge expense, and try to deal with that. But sooner or later, there's going to be problems. And flood control has simply been a conduit for pork barrel, for the government spending huge amounts in congressional districts for very questionable projects with minimal benefit. The taxpayers have just suffered greatly because of our concept of flood control. A much better approach, which was that I describe in the book, that originated with the Galloway Report, is a flood management approach, which means it makes a lot more sense to get out of the way rather than wait for the next disaster to happen. And of course, we have to remember Katrina was not a natural disaster. It was a man-made disaster. It was a catastrophe in the waiting. It was caused by the development of the area, the policies of the Corps of Engineers, their emphasis on building ship channels and levees. And it was predicted. I quote people in the book. I did the interviews in New Orleans a couple years before Katrina, and these crazy lunatic people down there were saying, this place is going to flood and it's going to be a huge catastrophe. I thought, oh, there's something in the water. Their drink is making these people crazy. They were right. Absolutely right. They called that one. So we have a number of Katrinas in the making in the United States today, where we are creating human-made disasters, and we need to start mitigating that and thinking about it, how to get out of the way of disaster rather than setting ourselves up for disaster.
Our time is short, and notwithstanding the Katrinas and the dumb dams and some of the dark spots that still cloud river health today. I mean, you call this book a book of hope. Yeah. What are the bright spots? I mean, what's the future for America's rivers look like, and why are you optimistic about it?
there are rivers being restored all over America, and they're coming back to life. They're being used by people. One of the most fun days we had was outside of Atlanta in the Chattahoochee River. And it was River Day at the Chattahoochee River National Recreation Area. And my wife and I were standing there on the banks of the river, and it's just full of families and little kids and floaties and things. And the river's just a prized possession of those people. And we were surrounded by literally hundreds of square miles of suburbs, not a square inch where you can get away from it. But you could always go down to the Chattahoochee and have this beautiful river in your backyard. And that's what's happening all over America. And it was just such a delight to see these people enjoying this resource. That's a hopeful message to me.
Daniel McCool, he's a professor of political science, the director of Environmental and Sustainability Studies Program at the University of Utah. His new book is titled River Republic: The Fall and Rise of America's Rivers. And Dan McCool, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Coming up next, the Utah prairie dog and perspectives on new rules governing the threatened species. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Utah prairie dogs like to burrow underneath the runway at the Parowan Airport and dig into coffins at the Paragona City Cemetery. Some residents want to shoot the pests on site, but the Utah prairie dog is a threatened species with a population less than 40,000. Earlier this month, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service released some new rules clarifying how prairie dogs can be controlled. And today on the program, we're talking about the new rules and how humans and the critters can peacefully coexist. Joining me now is Laura Roman. She is Deputy Field Supervisor for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Utah Field Office, and she joins us by phone from her office here in Salt Lake City. Laura Roman, thanks very much for your time.
Sure, no problem.
Tell us about the Utah prairie dog. Describe the lifespan, the habits, the habitat of these rodents.
Well, the Utah prairie dog lives primarily in southwestern Utah, in eight counties. Most of the population is in Garfield, Wayne, Iron counties, where we also have development happening at the same time. So the development and the prairie dogs overlap in those areas. The prairie dog uses sagebrush habitats primarily, and of course they're one of the keystone species in the sagebrush ecosystem, meaning that a lot of other species rely on the prairie dogs for their own sustenance. So prairie dogs are an important component of the ecosystem.
How are the Utah prairie dogs distinct from other prairie dogs?
They actually look very much alike other prairie dogs. The Utah prairie dog is geographically separated from whitetail prairie dogs and Gunnison prairie dogs, which are the other species in Utah. But they are genetically different based on earlier genetic studies.
I understand the Utah prairie dog was listed as an endangered species in 1973, but they were reclassified as threatened in 1984. What's the distinction between those two, and why is it important?
Well, endangered means primarily that the species is bordering on becoming extinct, and threatened, of course, would mean that they're coming close to becoming endangered. So that seems like a very simplistic approach to it, but as far as regulations are concerned, and especially with the Utah prairie dog, the biggest distinction is that we're able to create what's called 4D rules for these species. And in the case of the Utah prairie dog, this 4D rule has allowed some control of the species in areas where they conflict with human uses.
So what exactly do these new rules say? It's where it presents a clear conflict with humans that the prairie dog, it can't just be a pest, like,
right.
It's ruining your garden. It has to be something more substantial.
Right. So we've had a 4D rule in place for a couple of decades now, in which agricultural users can apply to the Division of Wildlife Resources for a permit to allow them to control some of the prairie dogs if they're interfering with their crop production, for example. And that's important because a lot of most of the prairie dogs actually occur on private lands, and we want to be able to work with these landowners to recover the species. And so we recognize that, that the prairie dogs also create conflicts for the landowners, and we want to be able to balance the conflicts with the species needs on those lands so that we can hopefully work with the landowners to recover the species. More recently, there's been a lot of concern in the local communities because of prairie dogs on airport runways, as you mentioned earlier, and also in the cemeteries. And we agree that that airports and cemeteries and prairie dogs don't mix very well. There were certainly burrows in the airport runways and in the cemetery, and of course those cause conflicts both emotionally and from a safety perspective. And so we want to be able to address those concerns.
How was the new rule developed, this 4D rule?
Well, we put out an initial draft notice in the Federal Register, and we received public comments on that notice, and then we finalized that based on the comments and also peer review that we have on the rule.
So there is a point when city officials can eliminate these pests, but they have to go through certain measures before they reach that kind of ultimate phase. You know, do you have to still install fencing, relocate rodents?
Right.
Can you describe the measures before you get to that final stage of eradication?
Right. Well, as you said, all of the above what you just said. we don't want to wipe out prairie dogs everywhere, so we want it to be very specific to areas that are, you know, definitely a concern and also a very site-specific area. So before animals can be killed in these areas, the communities have to fence the areas with prairie dog-proof barrier, and that's already been completed at the Parowan Airport. In fact, Fish and Wildlife Service and the state of Utah and Parowan City paid for that fence. And fencing is about to be installed at the Parowan Cemetery. Paraguna Cemetery. After the fencing is installed, we translocate out as many animals as possible, and after that, the communities are given a permit to legally control those animals.
I understand you're a biologist by trade. When these rodents are relocated, I mean, do they stay in their new habitat, or do they have some sort of homing device and are able to find their way back to their original nesting areas?
Well, they can't find their way back like a bear or a wolf could. I mean, bears and wolves travel a long ways. So we don't anticipate moving prairie dogs from, like, the cemetery out to the West Desert or up onto the Dixie National Forest and having them come back. What does happen with any translocation of any wildlife species is that you do see a high rate of mortality of those animals because they're not used to their new habitat. But when we're translocating animals, we're looking at more than just the individuals. We're looking at establishing new populations. And so as long as we establish the new population, we consider that to be a success. Having said that, we've been very successful in the last few years, especially up on the Dixie National Forest. They've seen a high degree of success in their new translocation sites.
So what does the future look like for the Utah prairie dog, in your view?
Well, I'm very hopeful right now. We have a very big effort called the Utah Prairie Dog Recovery Implementation Program, which is a large cross-section of agencies and private individuals and local communities where we're really partnering together to try to recover this species. And it's been a much larger effort than we've ever had in the past. And so I'm very hopeful right now. Like I said, we're having more success with translocations. And we're also working with different entities to purchase some properties for prairie dogs where we can actually set aside colonies that we know are very persistent. Mm.
Laura Roman, she's the Deputy Field Supervisor for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service here at the Utah Field Office. Laura, thanks very much for your time.
Sure, no problem.
I want to bring another voice into the conversation. Joining us now with a view from Parowan is Parowan City Councilman Dennis Gady. He represents the part of the city where the Parowan Airport is located, and he's also been the Utah Prairie Dog point person for the city, and he joins us by phone from his home in Parowan. And Dennis, thanks very much for your time this morning.
You're welcome. Glad to join in.
How long have the Utah prairie dogs become a real nuisance for residents in your town?
Years. It's been several years that they've really been causing a nuisance. We've lost a lot of businesses coming into town because of them. And so we've lost a lot of revenue. We've lost development, housing developments from them. And we've lost, you know, the use of our airport at times. And a lot of money's been put into the airport to try to resolve that problem.
Can you describe the problems that you're having at the airport? I mean, it's not just a matter of a nuisance. It's a hazard.
Yes, it is. It's a very big hazard because they don't dig underneath the runway and to where you can't see the burrow itself until the asphalt gets warm and a plane will run across it and it'll collapse and you get, you know, the wheels stuck in the a burrow there, and it's very dangerous. Governor Herbert, when he flew down here to Senator Stoll's funeral a few years ago, he flew into Cedar City instead of Parowan, and because he didn't want to land at our airport.
So describe the measures that your town, Parowan, and neighboring Paragona have taken to sort of control the impact that the Utah Prairie Dog is having on the landscape there.
Well, at the airport, we have implemented a sort of a retaliation against them, if you might want to say that. We go out and fix the holes in the runway. We have to re-blacktop and put concrete in. Along the side of the runway, the safety area where they burrow up, we have to go level that back off because it has to be a level field in case a plane runs off the runway into that safety area so they don't crash out there. We've built this fence, 14,000-foot fence around the airport that cost over $300,000, and to keep the prairie dogs out, once we get these trapped that are in there right now, this fence will keep the other ones from coming back in. And over in Paragona, at the cemetery over there, they've built fences twice now to try to keep them out. And they've tried everything and anything to keep the prairie dogs out of that cemetery, and they're just at wit's ends to try to keep their cemetery, you know, the sanctity of it. It's ruined over there. A lot of people have said that they wish they would have never buried their loved ones over there because of the prairie dog problem.
So we're talking about the new rule, this 4D rule by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. I mean, what do you think about the new rule? Is it going to give you guys some relief down there?
It will help. Gary Frazier from the Fish and Wildlife was out here earlier this summer visiting us, and we had a representative from Senator Chavez, Department of Interior, out here, and you know, so where we had people, you know, from back east that are in higher up places to actually come out and look at the problem firsthand and see what it is, and you know, that's where we got things, the ball rolling, is once they finally got out here and looked at it. And the 40 rule revision will help us to get rid of them right now after we've trapped them, and it'll help with the cemetery. But our House bill and Senate bill that we put in, the House bill 2973 and Senate bill 1580, if we can get that to pass, which it's being worked on now, but if we can get that to pass, that will make the cemeteries and the airports exempt from the Endangered Species Act, which will protect us in the future about not having to put up with this problem again.
So the people in your town are hopeful at this point.
Yeah, we do have, you know, it's only a little 5-watt light, but there is a light at the end of the tunnel. We have gained ground from the last couple of years, and we're going to continue to push for the rest of the county and the other counties that are involved in this to help get this problem resolved.
In practice, Is the rule in place now?
No, it is not in place now. It has passed, but it has to go through the registry first and basically become law or whatever. It's supposed to go into effect around the 1st of September is when they're hoping to have it completely through all the paperwork stages, you might say.
All right. Well, Parowan City Councilman Dennis Gady, thanks very much for your time and good luck.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate you involving me on this call. So thank you very much.
Sure. City Views is a production of KCPW in Salt Lake City. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Ryan Cron composed our theme music. Coming up tomorrow, lessons from Vancouver on just what makes a good public space. We hope you'll join us for that discussion tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.